Hey, great podcast today. We start with, hey, how healthy are we? If we're going to go into a war, how healthy are we? You know, do we have enough bullets? Do we have the country behind it? Do we have our strategic oil reserves? How about money to be able to fight a war? We show you how much the United States is borrowing every single day and what it means to you and your family. Then we also talked to Carol Roth, the author of a book that just came out today, You Will Own Nothing. It's a great companion book with my book that is out, Dark Future. Really, they were written kind of together. We worked hand in hand on what are you going to cover that I can't cover, et cetera, et cetera. It's a great companion book. Dark Future is my book. Her book is You Will Own Nothing. Then we talked politics, and we kind of ended up in a very philosophical place on what is real and what isn't. Don't miss a second of today's podcast, brought to you by Relief Factor. If you are in pain, may I suggest you just try one more thing? I know, you've tried everything, you can't get it, and you've been to every single doctor you can imagine, and you've tried some of the strongest things out there, that's the one that's going to work, and nothing have. And then I come to you on the radio or in the podcast, and I say, no, really, you should try this, you know? It's all natural. If you're like me at all natural. That is, either it doesn't taste good if it's a food, or it doesn't work if it's a medicine. This is the very first thing that I have ever tried that is, you know, all natural, that reduces inflammation. Nothing ever works for me on that to get me out of pain. This does. Will you just try it? Go to relieffactor.com. Get the 3-week quick start. Relieffactor.com or call 800, the number 4, relief. 800-4-RELIEF. Here's the podcast.
You're listening to the best of the Glenn Beck program.
I think one of the problems we have with America is a lack of storytelling. We're telling our history in dates, and then we're telling our future in movies, and we're doing it in a way where it's not credible. I mean, this is why I wrote the book Dark Future, which pick up your copy now, wherever books are sold. It has, I don't even know, 1,000, 2,000 footnotes in it. Because people need to understand that this is real, not science fiction. And I'm up at the ranch, at the Standing Rock Ranch, and every year I am holding a symposium here at the ranch with the Inspired Arts League. And we have some of the best artists in America. I mean, it's Jeremy Lipking and Albin Veselka and Adrian Stein and Quang Ho and all of these people from all over the country and the world coming here, and we learn story, how to tell stories, because people, you know, when you went into the churches in the medieval days, that's what the stained glass windows were for. People couldn't read, and so they would look and they would learn the story through art. We have a guy who is here who's teaching us this week, and he is he's the guy responsible for the design of some of the best movies you've ever seen, far as, you know, animated movies. Aladdin, Beauty and the Beast, Little Mermaid. He did all of, you know, a lot of these movies. And then he went on to work with Marvel to problem solve for Marvel. The problem is we have lost our story entirely. And it's being replaced right now. That's what the book Dark Future is about. The great narrative. It's being replaced with a new story and new traditions. You remember what Michelle Obama said? We'll have to have new traditions. Well, we do. Pat is here to talk to us about what this month is celebrating, which, of course, I know, Pat, because you're not a hater. Mm-hmm. You've already been making a big deal out of it in this new tradition. Mm-hmm. It's, of course, July is...
Of course. And I'd never insult, listeners to the show by speaking it out loud, something they already know so well. You know?
Really?
Wow.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow. That's how holy it is to you.
Yes,
wow.
Exactly.
Wow. That's exactly. That is good.
In a way, I now feel bad for even that, because we have said the name, because we obviously are so in tune with this.
And so in tune.
And now I feel like
our listeners are going to be, they're going to be sick of us repeating the name of what we're celebrating this week.
Which is Glenn, of course.
This month.
Glenn?
Handicapped Pride Month.
Definitely not handy. When's the last year they used handicapped in one of these names?
Like 1840, maybe?
It is, of course, as we all know, Disability
Disabled.
Pride Month.
Disability.
Of course. Yeah.
Pride Month.
You're proud of your disability.
Well, yes. And you actually got it right, Pat. Of course, as you mentioned, you're an expert on this.
Yeah.
But honestly, I actually at first thought, are we celebrating like another version of Pride Month for disabled people? Do they get their own
like the
month?
One-legged lesbian,
right?
Is that
right?
Okay, is this her month?
But no,
is
no,
this her month.
It's just celebrating people generally who have disabilities, so they're taking pride in these disabilities.
Okay.
Right. Which, of course, we all know.
I've got my tree up. I've had my tree up since May. I get so excited about
this. Do you decorate yours with prosthetics like I do? Because
well, no, that's a good idea. I just take all the toy soldiers and break a leg or an arm off.
Okay.
I can't even believe how many different months there are. We went over this when one day you were out, Glenn, and we went through the whole calendar.
But that was LGBTQQIA 2+.
2+, which stuff. I guess would not include disability
Pride Month.
No, of course not.
No. That's right.
Unless you're gay or bi or two-spirited, then you would be in that group if you were that and disabled.
Right.
But now I think it's a little unfair, because if you're gay and disabled, you get 2 months.
What if? Well, I think you should get 3. Honestly, I mean, shouldn't August be Disability Pride Month?
Oh,
I'm just throwing it out there. Seems like we should embrace this.
It probably will be next year. Yeah, it probably will be.
Okay. All right.
It really is incredible. I don't know how we got
here. I slowly but surely.
Yeah.
Steadily. And we ignored too many things.
You know, it's like, how does somebody go bankrupt? Very slowly and then all at once.
Yeah.
We didn't notice the very slowly part. And we're noticing the all at once part, which is so good, as we're here on the eve of not only another very special Pride Month, but also on the eve of World War II. I think, or three. I think that is, man, I feel warm inside. I feel like 7,000 degrees warm inside, but just really, it's really special. It's
I go back to last week, and the original story that Kamala Harris told about the two frogs, you know, because that nobody's heard that.
Wait.
And it really resonated with me.
Did she write that? Was that an original piece of writing?
She wrote that, I think, just last week.
Okay.
Yeah.
Good heavens. I've missed the Kamala Harris.
Oh, you missed the
How did I miss it?
Oh, man.
Oh, yeah.
Apparently, Glenn, if you put one frog in a pot of water and you slowly turn up the heat, that frog's just going to stay in there and enjoy it until he dies. But the other frog, if you put the frog in the water and then turn it up really high, really fast, that frog will jump out of the pot.
Wow.
And that's what happened to us, right? Mm-hmm. We were the first frog.
I don't think that's actually true.
It isn't true. No, it isn't.
Yeah,
it's not true.
So,
both frogs will jump
out
of the pot.
It's a nice fairy tale.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, again, again, a very nice fairy tale given to us by Kamala Harris.
Indeed.
Now, I don't know if you saw this, but if Biden were to drop out, there is a three-way. This is how bad it is for the Democrats. There's a three-way tie. 18% of Democratic voters would say, I'm with Kamala Harris.
Okay. You think the sitting VP would have 75% of the vote, right?
Yeah,
that
should
think.
Eight.
And it's 18.
Which I thought was high. 18. Second is Hillary Clinton at 15.
My gosh.
Third is Bernie Sanders at 12.
Yeah, the Democrats are in good shape, aren't they?
Yeah. The best part about this poll is the face made by Gavin Newsom when he reads
it. Oh, yeah, I love it.
I love the idea of this guy sitting there opening up this poll and realizing he's not even in the top three because you know what? He really thinks he's in the top three. He thinks he's number one by a mile.
He does.
And he's not.
Well, you also have those receiving at least 4%. California Governor Gavin Newsom, Pete Buttigieg, Robert F. Kennedy, Elizabeth Warren, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, and Stacey Abrams. I mean, you could pick any of those, I'd be happy. You know what I mean? Oh, my gosh.
They really do have a bad
Gosh.
They do.
They don't have nobody. They have nothing.
Is AOC even old enough now to be president?
She turns 35 in October.
Okay. I didn't think she was currently.
She isn't currently.
But in October, she is.
She would qualify for it because she turns, I think it's October.
You were such an ageist. You're going on that old dusty document, and you have to be at least 35. What an ageist you are. Mm-hmm. I'm so sick of it.
I know. She could just identify as 38, you know? Why not? We're changing everything else.
By the way, before we get to Stacey Abrams, let's remember that Biden is still in the race, but he's facing two foes. One is Robert F. Kennedy Jr., and the other that doesn't get a lot of talk is self-help author Marianne Williamson. And she'll cuddle. Mm-hmm. She'll cuddle with Putin. And it'll be, I mean, the war will be over. She'll be like, let's hug it out.
Can I make a potentially unpopular point with the audience for a moment here? Have we come to the point that we've oversold how well RFK Jr. is doing in this race? Like, I understand that there's a lot of people on the right who have this affinity, this sudden affinity for RFK Jr.
I don't.
You don't, Glenn, because, you know, he basically threatened your life in front of thousands of people. So I can understand why you might not be coming along for that one. He accused you of treason and said you should be treated like a traitor
With Rush Limbaugh. This is over climate change, right?
Over climate change.
Yeah. But I would like to say it's overstated. He said thousands of people. It was on CNN, so it was maybe a couple hundred people.
No, it was at a big live event. He said it on stage at a massive live event where there were a lot of people who saw it.
Mm. Wow.
And like, I get that, like, as I've said it, the fact that RFK Jr. is hitting 20% is a crazy, crazy thing. It shouldn't happen. And it shows how, one, there's a lot of name recognition for RFK Jr. Two, he probably is connecting with some people in the Democratic Party. Yeah. Three, Joe Biden's really, really bad. So there's a point to make there that he's hitting 20%. However, I will say, everyone says this, that he's hitting 20%. That one poll where he hit 20% was 2 months ago. He's now had 2 months of polling where he has not hit 20%. He is behind.
What does he hit?
He's let me see. I'll bring it up here in a second. If let's see, Democratic nomination. He has not hit 20% in 2 months. He's been hitting between 8 and 8.
Wow.
15.
Oh now, man.
And we joke. Wow. A lot of people will sit here and say, "Oh well, Ron DeSantis is a total disaster. He's 30 and 40 points behind." There hasn't been a poll where RFK Jr. has been within 40 points at all. I mean, it's been months at least since we've seen that. In addition, the Marianne Williamson thing is interesting, right? Marianne Williamson, we can all agree, is a zilch of a candidate, right? Like, she's not a real candidate.
Yes.
She is nothing, right? Mm-hmm. Like, no offense to her, but, like, she does not have a constituency. She is just basically nothing. Like, let me give you a couple of polls here. Like, the Yahoo News poll from, this is from June 20th, Biden 67, Williamson 4, Kennedy 8. Like, okay, he's 4 points ahead of Marianne Williamson in this poll. Sure. Right? Like,
so he's doing really well.
Right.
Yeah.
Some polls he's up by 10. Some polls he's up by, you know, like he's up by 11.
Her.
He's up by 7. Yeah, he's up by 12 over her. But like, that is the difference between you could throw any name on there and they're going to get the 7% in one of these polls. Mm-hmm. And he's getting 12. Well, he's getting 17. Well, he's getting 15. Like, I'm not saying it's nothing, right? He's shown, like, some ability to connect to the right and to the center, which is impressive, right? There are some things he's doing.
Crazy.
But let's not overstate this.
He's not competitive in this race at all.
No.
He's losing by 40 and 50 points in every single poll.
Mm.
And but that's only because once you get Marianne Williamson to drop out, you know, then that thing is a juggernaut.
This is the best of the Glenn Beck program.
I wanted to bring Carol Roth on today. She is the author of a new book, comes out today, You Will Own Nothing. It is a great companion book for my book, A Dark Future. If you go and you buy one of them, you'll see these two items most bought together. Because I'm showing you the mechanics of the machine. And Carol, it takes not only the mechanics of the machine, but she takes it and now lays it out for what your life is, what it's going to look like, how it's going to come down, and more importantly, what to do about it. Hi, Carol. How are you?
Hi, Glenn. I'm doing well. And again, congratulations on Dark Future. And I do love seeing that every time you go to one of those online sites and they say, these books are frequently brought together. Dark Future,
yeah,
You Own Nothing. Because we've been strategizing on this together and talking about it for like well over a year.
So, Carol, I want to just take you through the chapters of your book, because it starts with socially unacceptable and social credit scores. And there are so many people that don't know about social credit scores, or when they hear it, they're like, that's crazy. That's not going to happen here. It is happening here. So take me through chapter one, just highlights.
Yeah, so with chapter one, we really kind of see what's happening with social credit. And I would offer that there are sort of three phases. One is cancel culture, where it's really, you know, kind of people going after your social standing, which is the way that you get opportunities. They go after your jobs, which is obviously your income. And in some cases, they go after your business. And that gets kind of formalized into a sort of hybrid, loose social credit system. You know, maybe the state's involved, but, you know, they haven't kind of formalized a number grading system. And then you get to what China has, which is a full graded system, although it's still developing and it's sort of on a jurisdiction by jurisdiction basis. So if you think about what happened during COVID, if you were wrong think, if you were the ones who weren't wearing masks and, you know, not taking a vaccine, people were coming at you, whether it was your neighbor or in some cases the state. You couldn't go to a restaurant. You know, in some cases were, they took a picture of you and put it on social media that you weren't wearing a mask. They were calling your employer. If you think about what the Biden executive orders, you in some places couldn't have a job, or just the threat to businesses from the state that this executive order came down. Well, we're not really in it and required, but boy, we don't want to take that heat. So we feel the pressure, even though there isn't sort of that formal mandate to us. And then we actually saw the taking of assets, right? We saw businesses, particularly small businesses, being shut down, again, not based on data and science, but based on political clout and connections. Our neighbors to the north, if you were part of that trucker freedom convoy, you saw your bank account being seized. And we're seeing it, you know, it across, you know, being deplatformed. We're seeing collusion with the state. So this idea that, you know, that social credit is just about, you know, quashing your right to speech, there's a huge financial tie there as well. And really trying to manipulate people's behaviors, you know, whether you're Joe Rogan or Dave Chappelle or, you know, just a person on the street, trying to manipulate that based on what a small group of people are saying is moral and right.
So you say this leads us to a new financial world order, but you say it's coming in two parts. And the first one is about debt.
Yeah, so the whole concept of a new financial world order, a new world order, sounds very conspiratorial. And one of the things that I wanted to do with this book is take the conspiracy theory out of it. because, you know, it's very easy for people to say, oh, you know, New World Order, that sounds tinfoil hatty, I'm going to dismiss it. But as you wrote also in your book, and I cover it in You Will Own Nothing, you, all you need to do is go to the White House's website, you look at the speech that Joe Biden gave to the Business Roundtable March 21st, 2022, and he walks through this. New financial world orders happen on a regular basis. We're about 80 years into ours being at the center of the financial universe, but before us it was the British, and before the British it was the Dutch. And so this is something that if you are elite and well-connected, you already know. And so, you know, Joe Biden says this. He says, you know, it's going to, every three or four generations, there's a new financial order, and there's going to be a new world order out there, and we've got to lead it. And I'm pretty sure when he's talking to the Business Roundtable, he's talking to those business elite, probably not me and you, Glenn, and probably not the people who are listening here today.
Exactly right.
Yeah, so if you're these people and you're seeing that the global financial stakes are shifting, do you just kind of sit back and hope everything works out for you, or do you jockey to try to make sure that you and your cronies stay on top, retain your wealth, and retain your power? I don't think it's at all conspiratorial. I think anybody with a brain would say, of course you're going to try and do those kinds of things. So this
and
first
It's not necessarily, hang on just a sec, I'm sorry to interrupt, but it's not just, we expect that to be true. When 2008 came along, in 2006, I was talking to the guys that were all in Wall Street and financial sectors, and I said, guys, this doesn't work. And they would all fall back and say, Glenn, there's too much money at stake. All of the big thinkers are making sure that everything is taken care of. Well, we expected that. That's what their excuse was. You don't understand the system, and there's too much money at stake. There's too much money at stake, and so all of the big players, they know that. And what are we going to do to protect it? So it doesn't have to be nefarious. In this case, I think it is, but it doesn't have to be nefarious. It's logical that they would do that.
It very much is, and it's a very much a rhyme of history. It's that famous saying that's attributed to Mark Twain, that history doesn't repeat itself, but it often does rhyme. And so you can kind of see these cycles, and lots of thinkers who are very well regarded will talk to you about these historical cycles. So when you look at this new financial world order, one of the things that occurs to me is that major economies don't, you know, get sort of taken over by the outside. They really implode from within. And you can go all the way back to Rome from this, right? This is all an internal undoing that, you know, maybe there's a catalyst at the end, but it goes from, you know, basically where you have stable money to having way too much debt and excesses, and then you have to let your military lapse and all these kinds of things. And so that's really where this first part of the new financial world order is all the things that we have done internally to put ourselves in this position, whether it's having public debt to GDP of 125%, which even, you know, the IMF has said is unstable, the Treasury has said is unstable, the CBO has said it's unstable, so that does not sound very conspiracy theory to me. Whether it's the Biden administration weaponizing the dollar when they decided to freeze Russia's reserve assets after they invaded Ukraine. The fact that the Fed has not kept the dollar stable on the international stage. Oh, by the way, they haven't kept it stable at home either, which is an amazing feat. Usually it's one or the other. So all these kinds of things move us, you know, in that cycle that we have at that being at the center of the financial universe, all of these things move us further to the edge. And we're all seeing the repercussions. We're seeing some of the de-dollarization already. We're seeing the BRICS countries come out and say we're trying to have a new currency. We know the impact of the debt load. We've seen the inflation. Again, all of this is very well documented, and so really important and center to You Will Own Nothing was me going in, and, you know, almost every paragraph has a little note on it where you can find the information. And if I had a choice, by the way, of where to source the information, I went to the corporate press, because it's much harder for somebody who's trying to say this is a conspiracy theory to say, when I point out, oh, this was in the Washington Post and Reuters, whatever, it's much harder for them to dismiss it.
So, Carol, let's talk a little bit about debt. The numbers are so big. that nobody thinks that anything's going to happen to this. They don't even begin to understand. And when we have huge debt like this, and let's say we go to war, we don't have the money to pay for the war. And when everyone's in debt and that bubble starts to burst, all kinds of bad things follow. What's going to happen to our debt? How do you explain borrowing $5.1 billion every day, what that means?
I mean, it's so staggering. No wonder people can't get their head wrapped around it. And I blame some of these people who are in the MMT area. That stands for Modern Monetary Theory. I call it a name that I heard elsewhere called Magic Money Tree. Because the idea is that if you own a printing press, you can never default on your debt because you can print more money, which I guess is true in theory, but it just absolutely obliterates the value of the dollar. And I think what so many people forget is that money is just a proxy. It's a proxy for the fruits of your labor, for productivity. It's a convenience so that we no longer have to trade and go, oh, well, I have an egg and you're a doctor and someone else needs a cow and how do we all sort this out? It's a proxy, but it's a proxy for that productivity. So if you print more dollars and there's no additional productivity, then you debase everything, at least on a one-to-one basis. I would venture to say that with compounding, it's actually a worse scenario. And we saw this over the past few years when everybody wanted stimulus checks. They said, oh, you know, I need my Donnie dollars and I need my Biden bucks here. You know, give me my $1,000. Give me my $1,200. And there were people like you and me standing up going, no, don't do this. This is a trick. You're going to end up spending $7,000 to $10,000 for the rest of your life. But most people don't understand that. So when you see the debt levels going up, there are a couple of things that are happening concurrently. One is that, you know, we no longer have these central banks around the world who want to buy that debt. And if you think about what happened during COVID, is who came in to buy that debt? It wasn't other central banks, and you know, for a large part, it wasn't your traditional investors. It was the Federal Reserve again,
which is just a collection of private banks. All the banks, the biggest ones, that are all in trouble, borrowing money from the Fed. The Fed is it's those banks. And they elect people to go sit in and give monetary policy for the United States as a private institution. So if you think the banks are unstable, they're the ones printing the money and giving it to us. That doesn't sound good.
No, and they're making up, when you think of a printer, you actually think of like a physical money printer. This is just an entry. It's like basically going into your bank account and being like, oh, Glenn, let's just put $1 million in there and we'll go shopping. If you and I did that, it would be fraud.
We'd go to jail.
When the Fed does it, it's monetary policy. I'm not sure how that sort of puts together.
And you talk about this in The Incredible Shrinking Dollar. This is chapter four. And I want you to go over the reason why this isn't insanity this time, or so they say, is that we have entered a new modern era where technology will control inflation. So we can print as much as we want, and yeah, it'll cause inflation, but we have the technology now to keep that under control. And that technology is just monitoring what every single person does, wants, and spends, correct?
Yeah, so this is sort of, you know, one of the big theses that we have is that because there is so much pressure on the Fed and the government with these debts that they're going to be desperate and they're going to be looking at any ways that they can get themselves out of it.
You will own nothing. Carol Roth's new book.
The Best of the Glenn Beck Program.
Let me start here because the Washington Examiner ranked all of the candidates that were in Iowa with us. And I think they rated him exactly the same we did. They said, Tim Scott, unfortunately for Scott, the interview with Carlson highlighted the South Carolina senator's least appealing side, his tendency to joke his way out of difficult situations. He had some non-answers, and that really didn't go well for him. But they didn't think he destroyed himself. Where Asa Hutchinson, a mess. Mike Pence, another mess. Nikki Haley, I think they had the same exact view on her. Tucker Carlson went easy on her. He chose not to go after Haley in the way he went after Hutchinson and Pence and didn't press her on some issues such as Ukraine. It allowed Haley to do things such as go off on a crowd-pleasing and plausible reading of the White House cocaine situation. Then Vivek, the youngest, 37, the youngest candidate with no governmental experience. Ramaswamy has made real inroads in the GOP race. Then Ron DeSantis, the Florida governor, was the last candidate to appear, and he was the best. I think that's exactly the way we rated all of the candidates. And this is from the Washington Examiner.
Yeah, I think that's a fair rating. I think just pure performance-wise, I had Ramaswamy slightly ahead of DeSantis. I think, you know, there's a difference between those two candidates in that, you know, Ramaswamy has a lot more to gain, right? People don't really know. It's sort of the first time that a lot of people have ever seen him speak. So I think he had more to gain there. Obviously,
yeah.
The profile of DeSantis is a lot more consistent with someone who could actually win the nomination, where Ramaswamy is...
You're not sure yet.
Yeah. I think, you know, if you think about this the way this race has kind of spread out so far, you have obviously Trump at number one and DeSantis at number two. And then you have a huge group of people that you expect at some point someone's going to have a moment. If you think about the Pete Buttigieg run in 2020, like it's a parallel that you could see Ramaswamy potentially hitting, right? Where he's a really, you know, he's a good communicator. Can he get to 13, 14, 15% in these polls? I think it's possible. Yeah, I think that's legitimately possible. And that's about what Buttigieg did.
I'm hoping that he is a vice presidential candidate. And, you know, I said earlier, I think that Ramaswamy will be the candidate that Donald Trump chooses. I have no idea because Trump could choose anyone. And blow this all to hell. But Ramaswamy is the kind of guy that is a out of the box thinker. I think he would be deferential to Trump. The only problem is that Donald Trump might think that he might be overshadowed by Ramaswamy. But I don't think Ramaswamy would do that. I think he would play a role, but he would be a very good advisor to Trump. So yesterday, Ramaswamy released a list of people he would consider nominating to the Supreme Court if he were elected president. Two of the candidates, Ted Cruz and Mike Lee. And I wish those were the only ones on his list, because I'd like to see both of those guys on the Supreme Court. And the next president could nominate, be responsible for two other justices on the Supreme Court, and one of them might be a replacement for Clarence Thomas. And if he's not replaced by a Mike Lee or a Ted Cruz, we're in trouble. We need somebody who reads the Constitution as it was written. I personally, even if we had control of the Senate, I would lose control of the Senate for those two. If they were both put onto the Supreme Court, I wouldn't care if we lost the Senate. Those two would be so important.
Yeah, two seats of the Supreme Court, I think, would outweigh a couple years of Senate control. I would agree with you on that for sure.
Yeah.
Especially with the Republican president. Though, I mean, there are other good judges you could go to. But Mike Lee would be fantastic on the Supreme Court.
He is Mr. Supreme Court. And He's I don't mean this in a bad way, because I love him and he's very funny in person. He is really very funny in person, but he's boring enough to be on the Supreme Court. You know what I mean? He's like, you're never going to see like, Mike Lee swinging, you know, with the transvestite. It doesn't happen with Mike Lee.
No,
there's never going to be a scandal with Mike Lee.
I would agree.
He'll just, his scandal will be, well, I read both sides and I read the Constitution and I think I have to side with we the people. That's as exciting as it'll ever get.
Yeah.
And to me, that's the Super Bowl of excitement that I want from Mike Lee.
Yeah. I want to return to some boring politics every once in a while. I think, though, the new thing with candidates letting their Supreme Court picks out in advance. I like it. I mean, Trump was the trailblazer here, mainly because people didn't trust him on this stuff. And he put this out. Now, of course, he did wind up picking two of his three justices that were not on his initial list, which I don't like that. But still, he did. The first one was on the list, and that's essentially all he really promised. And, you know, I think you have the three. Kavanaugh, I'm still a little, you know, not so warm about, but the other two I'm pretty okay with. I think he did a pretty good job there. And certainly, like, regardless of how these justices turn out, the fact that they got Roe versus Wade overturned is so monumental that it's hard to ever be critical of this. And I like the idea of, like, these candidates coming out and saying, here, this is a statement of principles. And they talk about a budget is essentially a statement of your principles, right? Where you really want to spend your money shows what you actually care about. This falls in that same category. And I wish they all would do this. I think that would be a really positive thing going forward.
I think there's a change coming, though. I really do. I think we are on, if it's not this election, it will be the next election where we are going to have a generational change. And, you know, assuming that we have a country or another election, I think we'll finally get these damn hippies out of power.
Okay, Archie.
Okay. There's another thing that he said yesterday, and I love this. He said, Biden's top focus appeared to be on diversity and race and gender. While I drew from diverse experiences, current and former federal judges and former Solicitor General, two U.S. senators, my sole criteria was to select candidates with an unwavering commitment to an originalist understanding of the U.S. Constitution, who also understand the unique threats to liberty in the 21st century, including lurking state action. Our courts remain the last line of defense against the overreach and weaponization of government. As president, I will appoint judges who will protect the integrity of our constitutional republic. I love that. He also said that he was signing the Women for America's Legislative Action Committee's Presidential Promise to American Women. Have you even heard of that? I looked it up today and I read it. I love this. As president of the United States, I promise to uphold the truth that women are exclusively female. Only women can get pregnant and bear children. Only women can be mothers. Under my administration, the status and dignity of women and girls will not be compromised in law or policy. There are two sexes. If you have XX chromosomes, you're a woman. If you have XY chromosomes, you're a man, period. Gender dysphoria is a mental health disorder. Affirming kids' confusion isn't compassion, it's cruelty, and that's the truth. That's what he tweeted out yesterday. Donald Trump has also signed this.
Can you imagine reading this to someone 5 years ago? They would think you were nuts. Like, every single statement in that is blatantly obvious, full stop.
Stu, we had a proclamation for the family that was released by my church in the 1990s. And it was insane. We all looked at it and went, what are they thinking? What? And it specifically talked about the roles of men and women and gender, and that gender is ordained by God and there is no changing of gender. All of this stuff. And we're like, what are they even thinking? Yeah. In 1995, they did that. Now it's kind of like, that seems pretty smart, almost prophetic.
Yeah,
If not prophetic.
They saw that coming, for sure.
It worked. You look at just 5 years ago, 8 years ago, and that's what I would really like you to talk to your friends who are lost in this and just say, look, we know each other. No offense. I am not trying to change your mind. I want you to change my mind. T- tell me the new information that you received. Because I know you, 10 years ago, you would have said, that's not true. So let's follow the science here. What new information did you receive about how this affects children, the suicide rate, anything? Tell me the scientific evidence that has changed your mind. They won't be able to do it. So if the science is on the other side, why did you change your mind? And what's happened? Because you are you're in a completely different in position, and a position that you would have said 10 years ago was the position of someone who was nuts. How did you get there?
You're totally right. And you know what the answer, of course, is? It's like, I don't know, Twitter?
Politics.
It's something outside of science and reality. And like, I almost feel uncomfortable calling this science. It's like these truths will be held as these are self-evident truths, right? This isn't even, you don't even have to go to science. We all know this inherently to be true.
Right, but I'm only using that, me scientifically, yeah. Mm-hmm. Because of an argument. I don't want to get into your feelings and everything else. Tell me, let's follow the science. Let's follow the science.
Yet this argument is entirely feelings. That's all it is. It has nothing to do with science.
Yep.
This is, what's her face? Rachel Levine. The very high-ranking official in our government who is transgender, talking about how children should have access to sex reassignment services. And Rachel says, quote, adolescence is hard and puberty is hard. Okay, yeah, that's true. What if you're going through the wrong puberty? There's no such thing as the wrong puberty. That's not a thing. What you're talking about is not an actual thing. There's no wrong puberty. That's not a thing. But then Rachel goes on to say, what if you inside feel that you are female, but now you're going through a male puberty? And of course, the answer to that question,
disorder.
Right. The answer to that question is your feelings are wrong. Your feelings are incorrect. He's talking about a child here. This does not mean the child is a bad person, but lots of people have feelings that do not align with reality. And so the correction to that is to correct the feelings, not to correct the body to match your incorrect vibe. If you feel that you are a man, we don't correct the body to make you feel that way. We instead work on you and your feelings so that you actually recognize reality, because that's kind of important in our society, Glenn. Na, na, na,
na. Hi, it's Jason Whitlock. Have you secured your spot for Roll Call 2.0, my annual men's summit in Nashville, Tennessee? Are you looking for an opportunity to fellowship with other believers, to come together across the identity lines the left have drawn to divide us? Join me, country music star John Rich, and Blaze founder Glenn Beck, in Nashville on Saturday, June 1st for Roll Call 2.0. We're going to listen to great music, eat fantastic barbecue, and hear inspiring speeches from myself, Glenn Beck, North Carolina Lieutenant Governor Mark Robinson, Pastor E.W. Jackson, and many more. Let's quit letting the satanic left sift us like wheat. Let's come together as men and talk about the sacrifices we must make to restore the unity and shared values that made our country the envy of the world. Visit FearlessArmyRollCall.com to secure your spot.